Bigger, better, faster, more. It seems as though all of us are actively trying to cram more and more features, functionality, and speed out of everything we use. While the world seems faster paced today than it has ever been in the past, the quest for performance and efficiency is as old as recorded history and almost certainly beyond. Getting more done in less time has always been a component driving human ingenuity. Few really understand or care why a microwave cooks faster than a conventional oven, or how today's GPUs vastly improve the speed of not just your Xbox games, but your Excel spreadsheets as well. Today's guest doesn't just understand how to improve system performance, he and his team have revolutionized the tools and methodologies we use to do it. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Michael Fortin, distinguished engineer working in the Windows division. I hope you enjoy this opportunity to look at the technology and the person behind the code. Michael Fortin began his career at Microsoft in 1997, where he worked on Windows 2000, doing development on tools to aid in improving system and application performance. Later, as a performance analyst, he took a more active role in overall system performance and fundamentals. Today, he continues to focus his attention on helping to ensure Windows has the right quality attributes such as performance, reliability, and security. And his efforts were recently recognized by Microsoft's Technical Community Network when they awarded him the prestigious Technical Recognition Award for Outstanding Technical Leadership. Join me now as I welcome today's guest, Michael Fortin. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Glad you could join us.
Appreciate being here.
Now, like I was saying, you know, performance is something that you've been spending your career at Microsoft on. What is it about performance that really kind of gets your juices going?
That's a good question. I think that it really comes down to a couple of simple things. You can see improvements in pretty short order if you put the right amount of effort into it. And if you do enough of those improvements, you can see some pretty outstanding changes in the way the system comes together. And to me, that's just pleasing. I enjoy doing that.
So, you know, having things happen on the screen faster and knowing that you had something to do with it, and you and your team, gives you kind of a sense of accomplishment. And
even things simpler than just something on the screen. I mean, just a shorter code path, a smaller amount of memory, quicker time to open a file, all those kinds of things.
Is it kind of like a puzzle for you for trying to unload all of these, you know, different performance features?
It definitely started that way for me. Now it's more of an orchestration challenge. So there are large numbers of things that we're doing at any given time. Adding features, improving the user experience, making the product more secure. Those kinds of things typically come with some kind of cost. And trying to find ways to improve the system's efficiency, even though we're doing more, is a tricky thing. Mm-hmm. And it is an orchestration challenge because you're gonna take some losses in some areas and you're going to get some gains in others. And then you have to figure out, is it going to add up appropriately? And you're going to have a winning experience at the end of the day, fast enough and yet, you know, fluid enough is our Windows 8's term, right? So we have to make both of those things kind of true.
Now, I would think when you're talking about, you know, performance and security, those are kind of sometimes in contradiction to one another because adding security is going to decrease performance, isn't it?
It certainly has the potential to do so. But we could get better at the way we secure the product as well. And sometimes the ways we used to use security to prevent the system from being attacked, et cetera, weren't as efficient as new ways of doing it. And so working on security can also be working on performance, which is kind of interesting. So I do think we're going to see increased security in the platform over time, but I think a lot of that increased security is actually going to come with improvements in performance as well.
And each of these things allows Windows to become, you know, better and better with each iteration of the system.
Yes.
Starting off with Windows 2000 is where you first started doing stuff, and now that you're working on Windows 8, ideally all the lessons you've learned throughout all those iterations are going to take and make Windows 8 even a better product because of that.
Ideally, that would be the case. Yeah. We've certainly learned some things over the years, what to do and what not to do, but also how to be effective in getting large numbers of little things to add up to substantial improvements in either computer throughput or responsiveness or just experience in general.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you see the work you're doing in performance affecting mostly the operating system functionality, or do you see it also flowing into the applications that other developers are writing to run on top of the system?
It definitely goes beyond just the operating system itself. So, I mean, I think if you look at the server side of the fence, for instance, and you think about a high-end database and all the things it needs to do to scale to take advantage of 10,000 disks, for instance, or a terabyte of memory, or maybe a few hundred processors. There's an amount of work that we can do in the operating system to make it possible for a large database to take advantage of those hardware resources. But there are some things that we listen to them and what they're trying to accomplish that we then turn into operating system capabilities that we wouldn't have done if we didn't involve them in the conversation.
So someone like the SQL Server team understands what they're trying to do within their application and how they would like the operating system to take and manage data in a way that makes it easier for them.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a, you know, both people talking to one another and helping things out. And,
yeah.
and I'm sure you're also interacting with outside developers as well and understand how their applications might be needing to run on top
yes.
of Windows as
I
well.
Mean, and it's pretty much everything. I mean, you know, what does a world-class email client look like on a Windows operating system? That's a question that we should be asking, and we should be involving the folks that are building email clients in trying to come up with that answer. Then what are the platform capabilities we need to have so that we can have a world-class email client? Of course, a world-class email client today is very different from one, say, 15 years ago. The amount of storage, the amount of local caching that's done, the interactions and round-trip times that you might have with servers and such is very different today. And so you answer the question differently at different points in time, but you definitely don't want to do it just from an operating system perspective. You need to involve the application developers.
So it's an evolution.
Yes, it is.
Takes place. Now, speaking of evolutions, I mean, how did your interest in performance evolve throughout your history? I mean, like, you know, as a child, was that something you were dealing with as well, or...?
Well, yes. From the very first time I got my very first work on a computer, it was pretty clear that things were either very fast or very slow, and it was very easy to have very slow things. And so I focused intently on trying to be a little bit faster, a little bit faster, eke out every bit of performance I could. And I was doing that very, very early on with my first programs that I was writing. And I started working very simple principles like, you know, the tight loop really matters, right? So I was writing games initially, as most kids who get their computer kind of start out with. And there's an inner loop in a game that needs to run extremely efficiently. And the more efficient you are at doing that, the richer the experience can be within the game. And so I focused heavily on that. But I also recognized that the computers themselves, especially the input-output aspects of computers, was something of a burden. And so if I could myself be efficient in how I worked, I also kind of could do more and be more productive.
So it's personal performance as well as computer performance.
Personal performance as well as the computer performance. And I kept seeing the relationship between the two of those things. And even today when we work, I see that a lot of the things we do to make the system perform better actually comes at the expense of productivity of the developers. And so we have a two-part job. We have to make the operating system better, but we also have to be able to allow developers to make forward progress at a fast rate too. And they can be in conflict with themselves. A good example is, you know, before code in Windows can move and be a part of the main branch, there's a set of performance tests that need to pass. That can be an onerous task for a development team or even an individual developer. How do we make it easier for them to pass those tests so that their code can be in the mainline branch of Windows sooner? And today I look at the balance and I would say we don't have it quite right. I think it is a little too hard for a developer to write a high-performing system component and get that into the mainline branch. And part of that is because while we want to make sure the mainline branch is efficient and it doesn't regress in performance over time, but the checks and balances we have in place are just a little too expensive. The debugging costs associated with why is it slower, why we're expecting it to be faster, et cetera. Some of those things are part of the equation, too. We want to be efficient in all of that.
So is that more a tools thing, the tools you're using to judge aren't right, or is that more of a process thing where the meetings and interaction between people are making it slow down?
I think it's the tools thing more than it is anything else. I mean, we try not to have too many meetings. We try to do things with online systems and emails and things like that. Sometimes complex problems require meetings, of course. But I do think it's mostly a tools thing, and then there's a training aspect of it as well. Mm-hmm. So we have to keep working on our tools. We like working on tools, so it's not a burden, but we have to keep working on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, your family, did they get you started in technology at all, or was computer something you started on your own?
Well, I do credit my mom with getting me started, simply because she was a secretary, and she used to brag a lot about how she could type in 90 words a minute. And I took a typing class, and I thought, I'm going to try and achieve those same kind of rates. It was a competitive drive in me. She had put a number out there. I said, okay, I could do. Well, I was never able to achieve 90 words a minute. But when the school got computers for the very first time, and there were many students who wanted to work on them, and there were very few computers, the typing speed that I was able to essentially bring to solving problems became a differentiator. And so many of the programs written by other students were input into the program into the computer by me simply because I could do it faster.
Were you charging for that on the side?
I was not charging for that. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And so the hands and fingers aspect of programming really came from learning how to type, and that was driven by my mom's, you know, putting a number up there and saying, let's see how you can do against that. And
so it's an early example of performance, personal performance, and how you could deal things, and how it actually helped things out quite a bit.
Yep.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. And what was your first computer?
It was a TI-99-4A.
I had one of those too, eh?
Yes. And it was a lot of fun. And I occasionally think about buying one on the internet today just to have it sitting on the shelf.
Yes. Sometimes you want to dust those things off and just kind of see, you know, do they still boot up? And if they do boot up, can I still remember how to use it properly? And
The thing that troubles me is I don't know where my original computer is. It got lost somewhere along the way in some move that my parents made. And so I blame them for that.
Yeah, that's terrible. That's terrible. Moving forward, I mean, how did you find getting involved in technology in high school in those days? I mean, since a lot of the high schools and colleges didn't necessarily have really full-blown computer systems, how did you get involved there?
Well, we did have, we had four computers in our high school. They arrived in my senior year, so it's not like they were there early on. And that's what turned me towards, you know, taking computer science in college as well.
And when you got it in college, what were some of your key courses you were taking?
Well, I remember being really challenged by operating systems class. So we were learning VMS, which of course Dave Cutler was part of helping design, and I was struggling with virtual memory as a concept. I just remember thinking, how does this actually work over and over and over again? But today, I love working on the memory management side of things.
Yeah, because that's an important aspect of performance. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what are some memories of working with other people in college then, and some of the computer stuff you did? Because that's going to form the basis for your career moving forward.
Yeah. So as an undergraduate, we had competitive kind of challenges amongst ourselves. So we had programming contests were given, and it was about who can get the solution correct the right time in the shortest amount of time, and then how efficient is the ultimate solution? So we challenged each other as programmers, as undergraduates, and that was a lot of fun too. So again, the competitive aspect of things, trying to make things fast, being fast in both producing the result, but also having an efficient result at the end of the day. I mean, it was there from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. What programming language were you using back then?
In high school it was BASIC, but we were using Pascal as an undergraduate.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss you using Pascal? Because Pascal is one of those languages where you use more in school than you do outside the world.
Yeah, I don't miss it at all. Yeah. I much prefer C.
Yeah. It's better for performance.
It is better for performance, but I think it feels closer to the metal, right? The pedal to the metal kind of aspect of programming is a little easier to see when you're writing in C, and don't feel the need to actually work in assembly language or anything like that when you're using C.
I mean, do you see certain languages as being like C and other languages as being better for performance issues or better just simply for personal performance issues?
So there too is a tension point, if you will. I do think that C# and Java are quite good for personal productivity, but it can be a little more challenging to produce a highly performing, large project with those languages. I don't think it's difficult to make a highly performing small project, but when something gets to be kind of big, then some of these inherent simplifications or abstractions that are presented to you from the language side can catch up with you, and you end up having a difficult time figuring out how to actually improve the overall efficiency. So programmer productivity might be better with a set of languages, and that's an important thing, but if you really want to design from the get-go to get the best overall performance, C is probably the best place to think about developing your software. I do think C and C++ have gotten pretty close, though, over the years, so I really don't discourage folks from using any language at this point. I kind of think about what solution they're trying to achieve and then say, well, here's what other people are doing. So it's a very important thing to think about who's kind of blazed the path in these areas. And if you're the only person in Windows, for instance, writing a service that's using C#, you're probably going to spend an awful lot of time exploring and understanding some intricacies of the space that, you know, isn't really great for you to be doing. The productivity overall might decrease because of that. And if you stick to something like C or C++, where every other service has essentially found a way to be efficient, you're probably going to have fewer issues that are unique.
Now, do you think the efficiency of the languages is tied to the language or tied to the compiler underneath the language?
I think it's tied to the language. And I also think it's somewhat tied to the programmer as well. So when C++ rolled out for the very first time at IBM, we had a bunch of C programmers, and they were all told, you're going to write a bunch of things in C++, like the TCP/IP stack. It's got to be completely rewritten from C to C++. And there were folks there that had no experience working with C++. So the language probably had some things that made it a little more challenging to write a highly performing TCP/IP stack, but the programmers probably brought the biggest amount of challenge to the overall effort. At the end of the day, we threw away all the code because it couldn't perform. And when we looked at most of the reasons why it couldn't perform, it was because the developers weren't really skillful enough in using the language capabilities.
understand the capabilities and features of it and using it properly. Yeah. So I think that can be an issue. But also, I mean, with C++, especially in the early days, since you've got more of a pre-compiler notion to it, you're writing code in C++, it's pre-compiling to C, and then going from C through the compiler to machine language, you've got that layer of obfuscation that now you've got to have to have a compiler that both understands how to use standard C as well as this marked up C in order to get some of the object-oriented capabilities of it.
Yeah. And debugging things was difficult for some of the developers at that time. I mean, they were looking at something and they're like, I didn't write this code, and yet there's a bunch of code here that kind of got produced by some part of the system. And most of the developers that we were interacting with weren't familiar at all with that. And so to them, you know, debugging became a larger challenge as well.
Mm-hmm. So for performance on a pure machine program level, not programmer, would it be better to be writing an assembly language then?
No, I don't think so. I think the compilers do a great job at actually finding the right optimal sequence of instructions to emit. And it's, again, you get back to the programmer productivity side of the fence, start saying that's probably not where we want the vast majority of our programmers spending their time writing assembly language. That said, we can, with every release of Windows, find some sequence of code that's better to be written in assembly language, and somebody who's really good at it should probably spend some time actually crafting that code. But that's a few Einstein class experts working on a specific targeted piece of code that's clearly proven to be of importance from a performance standpoint. That's a very different thing than saying, hey, let's in large numbers write code in assembly language.
So maybe something like, you know, thread management or something like that might be better off in assembly.
The simple things like memcopy and memcompare. Yeah. Those are kind of the ones where you kind of go, let's get that right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about, you know, after college and you graduate, what are some of your first career explorations?
So I had an internship when I was in grad school with Hewlett-Packard, which was very interesting from my standpoint. That was the very first time I got to actually see the source code of an operating system. It was HPUX. It was very exciting to me. It's kind of like, I can see how things actually work. And I got the right performance tools to actually take things apart in a way that I couldn't do when I was looking from the outside in at the source code. So we used to hack dev KMEM and various Unix offerings to try and figure out what's really going on. It's very different when you can see the source code. And that told me that, you know, I really want to work on an operating system at the source level. And so when I graduated from Ohio State, I went to work at IBM working on AIX. And again, it was fun to have the source code access, and then you have free rein as to what you want to do. Plus, the level and sophistication of performance tools that you can write is quite a bit better when you've got the source.
Right, okay. Now, when you're writing tools for performance, exactly how are they operating? Are they examining the code? Are they examining how the system is running functionally on the computers, or examining the data paths, or how do they work?
All of those things are possible. So the simplest of, you know, things is you've got to get the right level of instrumentation into the operating system so you can kind of figure out what's going on. But adding instrumentation itself comes with a performance cost, right? So there's this trade-off where, you know, you want to instrument every function or every line of code. You clearly have to find the right places to add instrumentation, and then you have to find a way to get the right information. And of course, you have to do that without perturbing the system too much as well. So there's something of an art to it. You know, what's the right amount of information, and how am I going to get little snippets of information and piece them together to essentially be able to solve a complex problem? So, you know, the standard set of things that we instrument today weren't possible in the past because the frequency of occurrence was so great and the instrumentation overhead was so great that you wouldn't do it. But today in Windows, we instrument every interrupt, every deferred procedure call, every context switch, some of the most frequently done things in the system we can instrument at relatively low overhead. Those weren't the kind of things we could do in the past. So in the past, we had to kind of leave a few breadcrumbs around here and there, and we had a harder problem to solve. And we left that to the humans to kind of do it. Mm-hmm. But systems were typically used for less complex things 20 years ago than they are today. Today, there's any number of crazy things going on at the same time, and piecing together the puzzle is much more challenging without good tools, and we're fortunate to have the tools we have today. And they're much more flexible as well today than they were in the past.
Now, you mentioned a couple times that having to instrument things. Is that meaning like, you know, adding, you know, function points within applications where you can actually see where the paths are going from? Or what's going on there?
So we used to do things with dynamic code instrumentation, or we used to produce a performance build, if you will, with special instrumentation compiled in. Today, we basically have gone inline to the source code. So where the context switch is actually going to occur, we actually put an instrumentation point in there, which is going to call out and log some data about that context switch, including a timestamp and some other relevant information about which thread we're switching from to, what are the priorities, things like that. So that kind of thing is all throughout Windows today. It's all pretty much compiled in. But we still have the ability to take an already compiled program, decompose it, and insert additional instrumentation points into it as well, and then run that. And that gives you a richer view into the application as well, but it comes with more cost. You have to always constantly swap out the regular binary with the instrumented one, and sometimes that could come with a reboot, and then you get into the programmer or the analyst productivity problem as well.
Now, by instrumenting, I mean, you're saying Windows today has these instrument points all the way throughout it?
Oh, yes.
Isn't that going to slow it down too?
Well, that's, again, part of the art of it as well. So I think if we took out all the instrumentation points when tracing was off, you would find it's, you know, well under a fraction of a percent of impact. So it's quite a low impact. I mean, what happens at an instrumentation point is essentially there's a global check. I'll take the kernel as an example. There's a global check for a single cache line to see is tracing on at all. And that's kind of it. So you've got a couple of instructions at some core paths that essentially are going to put a little bit of a tax on the system. But relative to the rest of the other functionality Windows is doing, it's pretty small. And then when you look at it and you say, what kinds of problems can I solve if I have that instrumentation versus the ones I could solve if I didn't have it, you recognize that the overall productivity of the Windows organization is increased if we have the instrumentation. So we're willing to pay this tiny little tracing is off runtime cost so that we can solve complex problems. Then you get into the next question, which is, well, what if I turn on tracing? How much overhead am I willing to pay for that? Well, we have a pay-as-you-go model. You can turn on some levels of instrumentation with very low overhead, so you can trace a whole day of disk IOs, for instance, and the user would probably not even know that was happening. Or you could say, I want to turn on tracing for every system call, in which case it's going to take lots of memory to be able to buffer up the events that you're logging, and you're going to be on every system call, so you're going to be adding a noticeable 2 to 3% of overhead to the system. But in general, the numbers are low enough that we feel comfortable that we should continue to instrument more, not actually remove instrumentation. And so if you look over time, you'll see that the progression of instrumentation has been pretty dramatically increasing.
And this instrumentation on the finished product, turning it on, what value do we gain from that? I mean, this system's already done. It's out and shipped. I mean, why do we need instrumentation then?
So I'll use performance as the example, but we could use reliability as well. So let's say, for instance, that we're looking at data points coming back from a 100 million machines running Windows 7, and we notice that some machines are printing slower than others. We actually can, at Microsoft, say, okay, for machines that have had that slow printing experience, turn on tracing next time they go to print. If that is also a slow print time, then we want that trace sent back to us. And so we actually then can debug it here at Microsoft and decide whether we're going to issue a fix. And so there might be a Windows update that addresses print performance problems. And so some next customer doesn't experience that. Or even the population of Windows customers in the market today actually get those benefits as well. So we do push out updates for performance improvements. The parallel there is, of course, the reliability world, and that's where actually the model was built. You know, you get a lot of crashes, eventually we get a Watson curve from that, and we can say, hey, these are the top crashing things, let's go fix those. And then Windows Update pushes out fixes for that, or it comes out in a service pack, or maybe it's the next version of Windows that has a fix for it.
So it's basically a cycle that allows the system to constantly be updating itself because it's reporting on what it's doing and how it's doing it.
Yeah, and we do have a team of people that literally look at the data coming back from the Windows 7 population and decide which things from those traces we should take action on. We also, in having those traces, we now have a pool of traces that we can issue queries across as well, which is very effective. So we can answer the question like, you know, what's the typical disk I/O load for people? Well, we can go look at those traces and we can see here's what we're kind of seeing. We've done that. We've taken that information and we've gone back to the drive manufacturers and the solid state drive manufacturer and we've said, look, we're pretty sure we know what disk I/O patterns look like on Windows. They look like this. And so we've written a bunch of synthetic tests that exhibit those same patterns and we expect you to meet these performance criteria for us to essentially say that's a good device or not. And then, of course, we've gone a step further and we've released those tools to partners as well so that everybody kind of knows, you know, this was derived from real traces on real Windows systems. We kind of know what we're talking about, and this is what we expect drive manufacturers to work on. Mm-hmm. And we do see very, very large improvements in the solid state drive space in particular, very substantial ones. I mean, we were, when the first SSDs came out, we were seeing half-second hiccups where the device would disappear for a half second. We'd ask it for some other I/O request, and it would be dark, and then it would come back. And the reasons for that is because it had processed some previous set of I/Os from Windows, then had some pent-up work that it had to address. Eventually, you get to a threshold where it says, look, I just need to clean house here, and it stops responding for a while. Now, when a disk stops responding for half-second periods of time,
especially once it's fast like an SSD,
eventually you're going to start seeing a spinning donut up at the UI screen.
Yeah, yeah. So. Now, the things you're doing today with Windows, I mean, how does that reflect back on what you were doing back in the early days at IBM? It's like, were the same sorts of performance issues you were dealing with then, or was it a totally different ballgame?
On the server side, I worked on a bunch of operating systems at IBM, but the one I spent the most time working on was AIX. And on the server side, the problem spaces are pretty similar. The scale is much greater now than it was before. When we started working on AIX to make it appropriate for running server workloads, AIX had one lock called the kernel lock. Literally, that was it. So the granularity was not good. And still today, we work on essentially what's the right granularity to have for locks, right? If we break up some locks, we increase some path length potentially, but we can have increased parallelism. And so that same class of issue is still with us today. But we scale to a much greater degree, support thousands of disks, terabytes of memory, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a similar type of problem, but it's at a much larger scale.
So computing is different yet the same.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Now, so after IBM, where'd you go?
I came here to Microsoft.
And what brought you here?
Two folks had left IBM before me, and they came here and they kind of said, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. It's like turning back the clock a little bit. It's a lot of fun, but we're probably going to ship. And what are you guys going to do? And I alluded to the fact I worked at a lot of operating systems at IBM. Most of them we did not ship as commercial products. They were great learning exercises for me. But, you know, at the end of the day, if it doesn't actually get to a customer and you can't talk to your mom about it, what good is it, right? And so that was part of the lure, that the prospect of actually shipping something and competing in the marketplace for the product kind of brought me this way.
Mm-hmm. And this was Windows 2000 you started on, right?
Yeah, in 97. I think we were still calling it NT5 in 97. Yeah. But yeah, that was the first product.
Now, from an operating system perspective, you doing on a personal computer, where at IBM you're doing more on mainframe operating systems, as I believe.
Well, it's a mix at IBM. So the six operating systems I worked on in 5 years there were, some were for server type things. AIX was meant to be a workstation and a server class operating system. But others, like, you know, I worked on OS2, I worked on that Taligent pink thing with Apple, worked on that Java OS thing with Sun. And then OSF1 as well. So there's a bunch of things like that that were, you know, some of them were client-oriented, some of them were server-oriented, some were meant to be both.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the changes in security and performance and reliability between the two systems, or is an operating system an operating system?
Well, some attributes of an operating system are the same across them all, but, you know, there's been this big fight that I think has been resolved, but, you know, what portions of the operating system functionality should be in the kernel address space and which portions should be in user mode. So, yes, they can be largely the same. Path length still matters, locking still matters, scheduling still matters, scheduling disk IOs with some reasonable heuristics still matters. But, you know, there's also the fundamental difference between, you know, something that's much more microkernelish in nature and something that's modular but allows for a large resident set of code to run in a single address space for performance reasons. Mm-hmm. I do think the shift towards more stuff runs in user mode has kind of balanced out now. We do have a fair amount of things that we run in user mode, but still there's quite a bit that runs in the kernel address space too.
Because, you know, there's different camps that, you know, some people want stuff in the kernel because it gives them more control over other people in user mode because it's more flexible.
Yeah. And there's better productivity in user mode than there would be for kernel mode drivers and such like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, performance is performance too, and you have to compete on that regard. So you can't just say, hey, for those reliability gains, we're going to essentially trade being competitive on performance. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the early days at Microsoft, I understand you're working more on the tools themselves. Mm-hmm. How did those tools work within the system? Are they the same way we're working with today?
Except for the level of efficiency and the scale with which we can do things, they're kind of the same. Yeah, when we first got here, there weren't too many tools yet running on NT that resemble what we have today. But by the time we shipped Windows 2000, they looked pretty close. And, you know, I think probably the biggest difference with respect to event tracing is that we now can kind of like snap from a point in time and look backwards and reconstitute what happened. So the what was that aspect of things is a lot easier. Whereas in the 2000 timeframe, we would turn on tracing and we had to have the whole trace from the beginning moment when we turned it on to whenever the problem occurred. And that was limiting because you don't know when the problem might occur.
Right.
So, but if you're kind of tracing in a circular buffer and at some point you say there's an issue and you can look back in time and from that, you know, figure out what the problem is, that's a very more... It's a more robust, more powerful solution.
So that kind of gets at the whole no repro issue. I mean, like, if you're in a crunch problem, you report it. If they can't repro it, that means they can't turn on tracing to figure out what's going on. Where now we can actually say, okay, a random problem, let's backtrack it from
there. So a lot of people now run with tracing on all the time, and they have effectively a what was that button. And that's very effective for us in terms of, you know, root-causing problems, especially the more complex timing-related ones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then after Windows 2000, what did you do?
Well, then we did XP. And then I like to remind people that XP Service Pack 2 was kind of an operating system release of its own. That was a pretty substantial set of changes there. And then we had those fun Vista years.
Yeah. Now, Windows XP was our first version of Windows NT. that was designed for the consumer market.
Yep.
Did that concept change performance much at all in what you guys had to work on?
It did. So, you know, we were obviously focusing very hard on being able to compete on a footprint level. So memory performance was really kind of the big thing. So the NT code base had a number of, you know, advantages over the 9X code base. Reliability advantages were clearly obvious. But it had compatibility disadvantages, and it was bigger from a footprint standpoint. So we might be able to use multiple cores and be effective at scheduling things on a multiprocessor system, but we were larger from a footprint standpoint. And so the paging problem could be a bigger problem for us. And so we spent a lot of time in the XP timeframe focusing on getting some attributes of the footprint down to a competitive level. It was difficult to meet 9X on that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some scheduling and other such benefits that we could leverage.
Now, you know, when I go around and I'm like my dentist or something like that, and I see Windows XP running, usually I give him a bad time. I say, running Windows XP? Since Windows XP was one of the things you actually worked on and got performance done, right, do you feel a sense of pride still seeing Windows XP? Or just, you know, you need to upgrade to the Windows 7 and Windows 8 eventually?
I don't feel a sense of pride anymore. I kind of look at it and I kind of think we've done a few things wrong over the years. One of them is that, you know, we stopped naming things after years. To me, if that was Windows 2001, nobody would be running it. Instead, we have 400 million people running Windows XP. So part of it is a naming thing. Customers, though, they're using computers for a variety of reasons. And sometimes it's just they want to get from point A to point B, and they're not terribly concerned which technology is underneath the covers, or even what the experience is. Others care an awful lot about it, and those are the folks that typically move to the newer versions of the product. I think we understand the market now a little better than we did before. People will stick with stuff. They prefer compatibility, a good enough experience for getting some set of tasks done, and no hassles and no headaches is something that they'll choose over, you know, a shinier, perhaps sexier, even more secure product, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think the security aspect of things is the one we should be a little more worried about. I mean, an aging software product is an easy target.
I mean, security, I mean, we haven't really touched on it an awful lot, but that's also part of what you're focusing on.
It's part of what the fundamentals team focuses on. So we have, you know, we have a pretty large team now focusing on a bunch of things: reliability, security, privacy, licensing stuff, deployment stuff, as well as performance and scale and energy efficiency, et cetera. So security is one of those things underneath what we call the fundamentals team's umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
So security is a very big, complex space. There are lots of people working on security all across Microsoft. We have a piece of it, which has largely to do with getting this version of Windows to exceed and surpass all the expectations with respect to security. So that's a little different than saying we have a company-wide or corporate-wide responsibility. We don't. It's about this version of Windows with respect to security.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you seeing the issues regarding security being changed over the years? I mean, performance, it's, you know, making sure things run fast. But security, pre-internet days and post-internet days, that's going to be a big change going on.
Yeah.
Do we see other changes that are happening there and things you guys have to pay attention to?
I think we do see differences. So I kind of think we're transitioning between kind of, let's talk about the anti-malware space for just a bit. So, you know, we sell products. Other products are free to detect malware that might have gotten onto our PCs. It's typically looking for a signature of a bad thing, so known bad signatures. I think we're transitioning towards, let's just run known good software on PCs. So signed software that comes from a trusted entity probably is malware free. And it's probably a safer computing experience for my mom, for your mom, for everybody's moms. It's kind of what we were transitioning towards right now. We're not there yet. It's still possible for people to get software from a variety of places that are, you know, not that safe and secure. If you look at the reliability space, for instance, and you say, I've got, you know, a data center machine that can achieve 5 nines reliability, when somebody might go, wow, you've got that level of uptime? You say, yes, I do. And the reason they have that availability is that they don't let somebody in there and messing with the machine. They put only known good software on it. They put only known good hardware on it. So known good people, known good software, known good hardware, lots of good reliability numbers to talk about. Security can be very much the same kind of thing. If you stayed on the, you know, known good list, you'd probably be getting a pretty secure experience.
Mm-hmm.
Not completely, though.
Yeah, basically, but not letting your kids in after hours to browse the internet and see what's going on in your big servers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as we're moving forward then, so you have Windows 2000, Windows XP, Windows Vista. Have you been seeing an evolution of your experiences and your work in performance and reliability through those years, or are you basically working on the same thing all those times?
It's not the same thing because the scenarios do change a bit, but there are some things that are the same. We still care about boot performance. We cared about boot performance way back then. We care about it now. So some things are the same. But I think the number of things people are doing with devices and the places where devices go is very different today. And so mobility, for instance, as an important attribute of the system has increased, and that means we have to focus much more on getting the system great for mobile devices. So that's a very new space for us. Obviously we've had laptops for years, but the level of mobility that we see today and the size of the devices is quite a bit different. So there's quite a bit of new stuff there as well.
Yeah. What about even hardware changes? I mean, we mentioned SSDs earlier. I mentioned GPUs in the introduction. Those are two things that really didn't exist back in the Windows 2000 days. How is that modifying things?
Well, I mean, we've always had some way of displaying things on the screen, and hardware acceleration for graphics has been around for a long, long period of time. So we're leveraging it more now than before. We're not using it for an awful lot of compute-type things. I do think that's something that will come. Specialty hardware can do some things with better efficiency, both in terms of power use, but also in terms of how long it takes to do complex things. So we're going to continue to see an increase in that regard. But, you know, even when I was way back at IBM, we had these things called deep adapters, right? And, you know, and really what it was some driver that you could offload some work to, and it had specialty hardware that it could kind of go do stuff with and do it better than the operating system with general purpose algorithms can do. And in the server space, you know, we've been, you know, doing, you know, offloading of TCP functions and stuff like that to very smart adapters for some number of years as well. So I do kind of think the graphics space resembles that to some extent. There are some unique things you can do with graphics hardware acceleration that, you know, really make some experience much richer. We're going to keep pushing on that. I do think there's a, you know, efficiency and performance advantage in going in that space, but it's a little harder to do the work there. So it's kind of akin to, you know, you need these assembly language folks working on some core kernels, if you will, but you don't necessarily want everybody thinking they can program to those spaces that effectively.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, I mean, with hardware, since Windows prides itself in being the operating system that runs on well-made hardware from their manufacturers, if we're relying upon hardware features of a particular computer for performance issues, don't run into trouble of not knowing whether that's going to exist on the machine it's being installed on?
Yes. I mean, just take Intel and AMD processors. There are subtle differences between the two of them. You might find yourself in a difficult spot if you optimize for the, you know, lowest common denominator, and you might want to light up some things differently if the hardware is, you know, capable in some way or another. So we do have to think about that, and that complicates things a bit. But so the bang for the buck has to be pretty substantial for somebody to say, let's code something up that knows how to take advantage of the hardware if it's there. I think a good example would be, you know, encrypting drives. So you mentioned SSDs. I kind of expect all solid-state devices to have self-encrypting capabilities in the future. Not all of them have it today. And so if you want to BitLock or encrypt your drive today, we use the CPU to do that encryption and decryption. It'd be kind of nice if the device did this for us. There's a key management problem, of course, but the operating system could be a part of managing how to handle the cases where the key gets lost or something like that. But the device itself probably ought to handle all the encryption and decryption and offload that from the CPU.
Isn't that offloading some of your own performance stuff and letting someone else take care of it instead?
It is, but I think that's the right place for it to be. And so we do expect we'll always have a software component that can do encryption in case there's some device that doesn't have it. Or I shouldn't say always, but for the foreseeable future, we'll be in that business. But if there is an encrypting device beneath us and it's detected, we should not be doing it in the CPU. We should let it happen below us.
Mm-hmm. So how do changes like that happen then? Is that Microsoft talking with the SSD developers to make sure they're adding that to their hardware? Or?
Yes. And we are pushing to some extent as well, saying looks like the right thing to do. The trade-off here would be good. You could have specialty hardware that does this much better than our big, giant, general-purpose CPU. And so that's a better energy story and probably an overall better performance story too.
So then thinking about performance is not just thinking about performance of the operating system and our work within it, but also just thinking about the bigger picture and where the operating system is running at and who should be owning what aspects of performance.
Right. So another good example would be wear leveling with solid-state drives. I mean, there were some proposals a few years ago about the operating system taking on that function, and it didn't make sense to me that we should do that. I think the devices themselves know their geometry. They understand the internal state of things much better than the operating system could. And their view of the device and how it's being used would likely extend beyond a single operating system installation. So imagine you took the drive and you put it in another machine. It would have a, you know, memory of, hey, how are my cells doing? How many have I written to? What's my, you know, likely failure rate for this portion of the device? Whereas the new operating system that you just showed up in would have no view of that. So there's some things like that where we decide not to do operating system specific things because we expect the device manufacturers to do a good job on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we're moving towards Windows 8, which will be shipping out, you know, some point in the future, are there specific new aspects of performance that you're focusing on for that?
Yes. So there's a whole bunch. I mean, I can touch on a few because we've talked about them publicly already. One of our most recent publications was about memory management changes. And we have a new app model. So apps can come from a store. These apps are known good, by the way. So there's been a store onboarding process where we've looked at them and said, hey, these things have good performance attributes, but also they have good security and reliability attributes. Some customer can then get that app. One of the new attributes of these apps is that we can essentially freeze dry them. And so that's a very interesting concept. The application, we can tell it, hey, look, we're just going to stop scheduling you for a bit. We might stream you out to disk. And at some point later, if the user interacts with you, we might stream you back in from disk. That's a swapping, if you will, capability that we've never had before in Windows. We've always been a demand paging operating system or a speculative paging operating system. But in this case, it's kind of like, hey, look, here's a few hundred megabytes worth of application. We know how to do a sequential burst of I/O, pushing that thing out to disk. And if the user clicks on the tile again to relaunch it, instead of launching the app again, we're going to stream it in from disk because we've done the math internally and we feel like that's a better thing to do. Faster to stream it from disk at this rate than to relaunch the app, which is an interesting new dynamic for the operating system. And there are many such changes like that that we've done in Windows 8.
So it's like an in-state application paging rather than memory paging like we've had in the past.
Correct.
That's an interesting way of doing it. Now, with SSD drives, that's going to be faster yet, because I know I've got an SSD drive machine. I'm noticing how much quicker it is on booting and application loading and stuff like that.
Right.
And so we can really take advantage of some of those features and capabilities as those things come out.
And we use less CPU to actually stream something in versus actually relaunching it, which is an energy-saving thing as well. So, I mean, it's a net win across many dimensions, which is good.
Yeah, we haven't even touched much about energy saving. Is that something your group works on as well?
Yes, quite a bit.
And how does that come into play with things? I mean, are you paying attention to the amount of code that's running and trying to shorten the amount of code or shorten the amount of time it's spending on spinning devices and so forth?
So we're fortunate that there are a number of teams at Microsoft who've been like ahead of us in the Windows division. So let's take the phone guys, for instance. And so we've learned an awful lot from them. Some simple principles like get idle and stay idle are things that you want to do if you want to have good energy efficiency. Other principles like if we're going to wake something up, let's do a number of things at that time. Since we've spent the energy to wake it up, let's get what we can done before we quiesce the thing again. So coalescing activities, whether it's CPU scheduling activities or disk I/O things or network things, makes good sense. So we've had to introduce new ways to recognize what kinds of things can be collapsed into a coalesced wake up and which things can't. And we've had to introduce new flexibilities in the OS. And so there's a bunch of substantial underlying work that had to be done from a mechanism standpoint. Once the mechanisms are built, now you have to figure out which policies make sense. How do you apply them appropriately? And the performance team spends a lot more time on the policy side of things, whereas, say, the kernel team spends some time on the mechanism building side of the fence. And together, we kind of come up with what's the right thing for us to be doing. With our viewpoint, we then kind of look at the self-host population of people, or the beta population of people, and we kind of say, what's really happening on these machines? And we have that view through telemetry. So like I said before, we can turn on tracing at pretty low overhead, and we can see what's going on. Those traces come back to us, and we can look at it, and we can say, how well are we doing? Looks like we woke up the disk to issue a single I/O, and yet half second earlier, we had the disk up. What are we doing there? So we can chase down all those things, play whack-a-mole, if you will, with all the little things like that, so we can get all of our stuff to coalesce and happen in a period of time that we think is appropriate from a responsiveness standpoint, a throughput standpoint, and as from an energy standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, does all that also assist the applications in running more efficiently in a shared environment sort of thing? Like in a lot of applications when you're running on systems, you've got Excel running, you've got a game running, other stuff running. Having the game pop up periodically to get some time it's needing or something, I can imagine slowing down Excel. How are you paying attention to that level?
We do pay pretty close attention to that. So if we have these new modern applications, which we have the most control over because we designed the whole application model for them with this in mind, that app can be told to stop working at our discretion. And it's been built to understand that when it's told to stop, it's going to basically be stopped. Its threads will stop getting scheduled, et cetera. So if you're working in Excel and you were running one of those modern games on the side, we actually can stop that modern game 100% and it won't interfere with Excel at all, which is kind of a nice thing. It's not quite the same when if you've got Excel and PowerPoint open because both those apps were written before this new model existed. And so if you're looking at the classic Office apps, they can still interfere with each other in the classic desktop space. That's not a problem we tried to solve for Windows 8. I will say this, though. When the screen goes dark, so we decide that the user's not present and there's no reason for us to essentially expend energy to keep the screen lit up, we actually stopped scheduling the threads in both Office and so Excel and PowerPoint, as well as those modern apps. So we have gone so far as to say, when we're idle and we really expect to be conserving energy, we're going to stop scheduling threads.
Yeah.
And that's actually worked out very well with us and had very few compatibility issues, which is the other thing we always have to balance, right? When you introduce new capabilities or new scheduling dynamics or new policies or mechanisms, you can't break the world.
Right, right. What do you see the future of performance and reliability and security happening on Windows and other operating systems?
I think energy efficiency continues to be a very high priority for everybody, and we're going to get better at that over time. Security, we've got to increase that. We're just going to have to look for ways to be more efficient. It's an ongoing challenge. When I look at the things we do today, there are a long list of things we can do more efficiently and therefore get better security. So we're just going to continue on that progression where both performance is improved, responsiveness is improved, and security is improved. We're not trading one too much against the other. There will be some steps we have to take, I think, in the security space where we do decrease performance or responsiveness because we want to have some secure attributes that we wouldn't otherwise have. We have a lot of choices, like when we run things, when we do checks for things, when we decide to re-optimize the system, et cetera. Those are choices we have. We have a bunch of background tasks that we can schedule to run at our discretion, and we have to pick and choose when to do those things, what's most appropriate to update the machine. We do these Patch Tuesday things and stuff like that. How long do we let the updates stay on your machine before we force them to get applied? Things like that, they all kind of relate with one another. We don't want to have to push down the update and install it when you're in front of the computer. It would be better for us to do it at some other time.
I know the one thing is I want to update come through and I get noticed about it. It's like, okay, am I going to have the update post now or do I want to take and wait until I finish my thing? But when I finish my thing, I forgot about the update and I never get to it.
So I think we have to progress towards being less disruptive. And so a good example would be, you know, why don't we auto log you back in after we've applied the updates and restart your applications to a point where they were? We did a lot of work.
Which, if you're freeze driving, you can do automatically.
Yes, we could, especially for the newer apps. And even many of the classic apps had opted into a restart manager capability that Windows introduced some number of releases ago. So we will relaunch IE to the browsed pages that you're at. We will relaunch Office to the place where they were. But we actually don't log the user back in. So we kind of like apply this update on you, reboot your machine, get you back to the login prompt, and then we don't go any further. And it's not until you log in again that we restart everything. And so kind of like we've got to complete some of those sequences.
Yeah. Now, performance. So it's been a big part of your career, big part of your education. How does it apply to your outside of work life? I mean, do you do performance things there too, or you try to get rid of it?
I used to. I mean, you got to be careful when you work in performance not to obsess about some things. Like, I'm not counting the number of steps between here and that door, and I'm, you know, sometimes I don't walk the straight line between things, and I feel good about it, et cetera. But there's definitely some aspects of the performance work I do that translates to the home life. And so it's more of a nuisance for the other members of the family, and so I try not to do it too much. In fact, I've kind of switched the other way. So driving now is an opportunity for me to listen to audiobooks. And if it takes longer to get from one point to another, it just means I got more of the book done, which is kind of a good thing. So I'm not overly obsessed by it.
So you go off the beaten path a couple of times.
I do.
Just to listen to the last chapter.
Yep. I don't mind sitting in traffic a bit.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Michael. I appreciate the insights you gave about, you know, performance and reliability and what you've been doing in the operating system through its various evolutions and what you continue to do for Windows 8 to make it even better than the rest of them. But before we let you go, we've got a couple of questions we like asking all of our guests just to get some idea about what their thoughts are about technology and life in general.
Sounds great.
The first question is, what's a book you would recommend everyone read and why?
I would recommend Mark Kurlansky's book. It's called Salt. He's written a number of books, but this one is about, you know, something that's kind of present in everyday life and you can kind of relate in conversations with folks. I torture my children with all sorts of tidbits about salt itself. The book is really a look at salt and its influence on human civilization over the years. It's quite a fascinating read.
Doesn't sound like a performance-related book at all.
It's not at all.
It's just one of those idle fantasies you're doing with stuff, looking at history and how things have progressed. The next question is, if you weren't working in the computer industry, what would you be doing today?
I do think I would be trying to write books or tell stories about things that are common in everyday life and how they've, you know, influenced how we've evolved. I think that's a very interesting subject to me. I think history in general, and focus more on some attributes, either technological advancements or just cultural things that have progressed over the years.
So that's kind of a personal passion of yours outside of work.
Yes.
I mean, like understanding history, I think, is extremely important. I mean, just recently, I was seeing on Twitter some people that were not aware of the fact that Titanic was a real boat,
yes.
and we thought it was just a movie. And that kind of, to me, shows how forgetting about history really can kind of disjoint you from life itself sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The next question is, what do you think the most important technology in the world is today?
The internet. I mean, that's a broad answer, but I mean, I think that it's changed the way people think about others. It's toppled governments recently. And then, of course, the productivity advancements that we've seen over the last couple of decades due to, you know, the changes in business, but also in the changes in the way we interact with family members. I think it's been great.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, speaking about history from that standpoint, one of the things I see people talking about an awful lot with science fiction and its reaction history, rarely did science fiction even have a glimmer of something like the internet.
Yeah.
How do you think that flows into the concepts of history and where humankind has gone? Is the internet a brand new thing that is totally different? Or historically, has this sort of thing happened over and over again, do you think?
Well, I'm not so sure that folks were thinking about the telephone coming along either before it showed up. So, you know, I don't want to criticize science fiction writers. Some of them have been just fascinating, and they've done a really wonderful job. But by and large, they're hitting on human dramas, I think, and they're interjecting some amount of technology here and there. And it's mostly about individuals and stuff like that. And occasionally you see the large-scale civilization-type subjects and such. But yes, you're right. They haven't really kind of touched on too much of the, mm-hmm. the internet.
So then thinking about science fiction and future history, 25 years from now, what technology would you like to see around?
So I've always wanted a flying car, and recently there was a flying car in the news.
Weren't we supposed to have one by now?
Yes, we were supposed to have one by now. And the darn flying car is really just a plane with wheels, so it's not quite there yet. But I don't expect flying cars in the next 25 years. I think the manufacturing space is something that needs a new innovation to come along. So every day on the drive to work, I see them building this bridge that I, you know, watch them construct. And, you know, that bridge is a very unique thing right there at that spot. And there's another bridge, and then there's another bridge, and there's another bridge. And all of these things are super unique in their construction. And I kind of feel like, you know, if we're going to automate anything, we're going to have to get to something that's much more standard and much more automatable. And so, you know, when we start thinking about automated machinery and its ability to essentially change things, it's going to have to start with simple building blocks that you can reassemble into different forms. And I kind of think in that space, we're going to see some pretty big advances in the next 20 years.
Maybe Lego blocks built out of big, gigantic pieces of concrete.
It seems almost that simple to some extent.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks. Now, we got one last question here. And here you got to, you know, exercise some of your artistic creativity. We'd like you to take and draw your favorite data diagram and make sure you sign it, too.
Okay. I am not very artistic, so I'll do my best with a box. Okay, so let's see. Let's see if I can keep my handwriting going, too. I'm going to call this that should be an E. I apologize. So this is a very common structure that's found all over Windows, and this is kind of why I've picked this one. But it's a little difficult to get right because there are so many different attributes, and I'm trying to get them in the proper order. That's header size, HDR. So each one of these things is, like I said, pretty well known within Windows. Then there's missing something. And that's kind of the end of it. And so this signature is, which is the equivalent of MZ. Do you recognize this data structure?
I do. Mark Zbikowski.
Yeah. So that's the DOS header. And it appears in every executable and every DLL in Windows and ActiveX controls and lots of other things too, even on the new ARM binaries as well, even though it's the DOS header from way, 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 way back. And so every time I disassemble something or I open a hex editor in a binary, the very first set of things you see is MZ at the top. Yeah. And of course, we're not really running DOS code on Windows anymore.
Because we actually jump past that to run under the Windows.
Jump right past it. But you know, it's there for all sorts of reasons, compatibility being a top reason. If you were just to change something as simple as how the beginning of every Xeon DLL starts, you would have a potential compatibility impact with tools across the globe. Mm-hmm. And so it's easier for us just to retain this, even though it's space and some efficiency loss, it's easier for us to do it. And so the balance between compatibility and small performance win easily sides with compatibility. But I can't predict the date when that will not be at the top of every Xeon DLL. My guess is when I retire some long, long period of years from now, it'll still be there.
I didn't realize that it was still there with Windows NT.
It's even there on the ARM platform. It's great to see it's still there. Mark gets a lot of credit for coming up with something that we couldn't get rid of.
Now, does it still run if you go like in the
if
old
you
days,
took that and put it on a DOS machine, it would run and display a text saying this is not a DOS executable. Yeah. It'll still do that. Yes.
I used to actually take and write Windows programs and actually write a DOS version of the program and bury that in there. So run on DOS would run in DOS mode, and Windows would run in Windows mode. Yeah, that's great. That's
anyway,
that's
so this is one of my favorites because I see it all the time and I laugh because we'll never get rid of it.
Yeah. There's history for you.
Yep, and then that's where the rest of the program goes. So sign it?
Give it a sign, yeah. Oh, that's perfect. Well, thanks, Michael, from the Techno Community Network for being our guest today.
My pleasure.
And we hope all of you enjoyed this chance. Look at the technology and the person behind the code.